But you know, it's a time for renewal and an exciting time when one begins a new venture in one's life and further develops their ability to grow and learn. Hopefully, you know, college should be a time of great learning and intellectual growth and personal growth and developing bonds of friendship, hopefully, that will last possibly, hopefully, a lifetime. And certainly as an old-time community guy here, I welcome and wish all of the students coming into the college, both freshmen and regular veteran students, all the best in their endeavors. You know, Tufts University is one of those campuses that's, you know, the spawning ground, if you will, of the future rulers of the world. You know, the people that come out of Tufts are captains of industry, of science, of medicine, politics, culture, economy, health, all areas of endeavor that that require expertise. You'll often find Tufts University graduates near the top of the heap. So, you know, it's a great experience for me as a community guy to just be here to get in to throw in my two cents as sort of as an outsider. To help introduce maybe some ideas that could result in some thought, some discourse. I'm looking forward to that in the fall. I hope to continue here. I know I've had a dust-up last year with someone who felt that I had, not that I had said anything, but that he, you know, I guess he was looking at me under a microscope and he found that my attitudes were not politically correct. This guy apparently was sitting in the cafe at the in the Curtis Hall, which is where our radio studio is, and listening to me, and he was just shaking with rage as he listened. You know, unlike in the old days, and by the way, I was here over 20 years ago. I've made a comeback here recently. I actually started the week before the election, interestingly. But back in the day, and back when I was doing radio here in the I'd say late 1990s or 1998, around that time, you know, if someone didn't like you, someone didn't like something that you said, somebody felt offended, they'd call you up. You know, you welcome the call, and there would be a good, solid, vigorous dialogue. The station back then was a fairly open place, and it was welcoming me as a conservative. Some people didn't like the fact that I came in here as an outspoken conservative. In fact, the station manager at the time, who went on to do broadcasting at Boston College, I mean, I'm not going to mention his name because it was a private conversation, but He was shaking with rage at me for being a conservative. He said, "Well, why don't you consult with a council, like a committee? That's how we do everything here. We don't speak on any issues other than getting." It's like kind of a communistic attitude. I mean, this guy was way, way out on the left. You know, a Soviet, which is, of course, the Russian word for council. And I'm like, no, not really. You know, here, my background is more of an American sensibility. I follow my own drummer. I believe in the individual. I try to be, censor myself, I suppose, both to be in the contents, in the construct of good taste, but also with an appreciation that this is a college campus and I can't just shoot my mouth off on anything any more than a professor can. You know, there's a certain amount of in loco parentis. I mean, this is, Tufts University, like all campuses, is a private institution. And so I have to observe the mores and the cultural antecedents, if you will, of the institution. And I respect that. But within that context, there was a very much an open forum, and certainly conservative ideas are not some kind of fringe, you know, idea. A large portion of the United States is conservative. I would argue that the United States itself is conservative, that most people who think of themselves as liberals, if you look at them in the context of world philosophy, of world culture, they are conservative. You know, they're certainly more conservative than liberals in Europe, obviously the far, left communist, and I would argue the far right, far left Nazi or fascist movements as well, which are to the right of communism, but a way out to the left of American liberals. American liberals are basically conservatives. So, my point being that conservatism is not some kind of a fringe idea. It's the very founding ideas of our republic. But yet today, when you come in and you make comments that have a slight conservative coloration, instead of calling me up on the air, taking me on, sending me an email maybe, coming into the studio, maybe doing a discussion, engaging in the debate, instead now they turn you into the anti-bias Gestapo. I'm sorry to be blunt, but that's what it looks like to me. You get reported. This is what they do in communist China, by the way. If you are politically not walking the line in the neighborhood, you have in communist China sort of a person or a group of people who are there to watch over people. Like it's a block manager. And they will report you to authorities and you'll get contacted and reprimanded and warned. And of course, in an extreme situation, you can disappear. I don't know how many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people in communist China have disappeared. I've heard about this from people. People have told me about it because they've been through it. The families have. China every year still, even though it's moved away from hard left communism, I think that on the record, according to Amnesty International, and that's only what they know, they still execute, I think it's about 50 to 60,000 people a year for political crimes. Not for crimes in the American context, but for political crimes, for crimes of belief, of thought, of activism. We should be grateful in this country that we have a free country where we can be activists, whether we're even people who are into the most repugnant sort of political activity. You still have a right to advocate those things. You don't necessarily have a right to act on them if they involve illegal or violent behavior, but you do have the right to your beliefs, and you're not going to get contacted by some authorities and taken away like they do in the very leftist countries, the far left communist countries like China and Nazi socialist Germany historically. So anyway, now you, instead of talking to me, there's the Gestapo, there's the this anti-bias group on this campus. If you say something that somebody thinks is somehow an expression against a person because of their mainly because of their ethnic background, not their belief system. I mean, it's really very racial oriented. Race, ethnicity, religion, and by religion, we know which religion I'm talking about here. And it's not Christianity or Judaism. If you say something that is perceived as biased against those groups, or gender, by the way, women, or sexuality, if you comment on someone's sexuality publicly, then you can be reported. You could be called in to this group. In my case, because I'm not a student, there's really nothing they can do to me other than take me off the air, and they probably will. I expect that at some point. And by the way, to my listeners, hello, you're on the air. Hello. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, can you hear me?
I sure can. How are you?
Fine. Listen, about a month ago, you was talking about in biblical times in the Palestine Jerusalem area.
Yep.
You was talking about a group of people that, in your opinion, were the first communists.
Refresh my memory, but before we go there, I just want to tell you, in biblical times, there was no such thing as Palestine. But anyway, tell me what I was, remind me.
Well, you were talking about this group of people that you considered to be the first communists.
Okay.
Well, my question to you is, what about King Herod, who killed John the Baptist? And what about the Sanhedrin court that convicted Jesus Christ? Wouldn't you say they were the first communists?
Thanks for asking. First of all, I think you were talking about not biblical Israel, but this group, this Mazdak group in Iran, in Persia, that he's often viewed as the first communist. And he came right before the Muslim conquest of the Sassanian Empire. He was a he became the prime minister under the Shah. He started to collectivize the country. He was into free love. He was into all this stuff that communists are into. You know, the creation of a new human being. You know, the new society. And the person that took him on actually was the Jewish exilarch in Baghdad at the time, that being Marzutra. And Marzutra was able to have him taken out and killed and executed, and then he became the prime minister and restored Iran to its previous state, which was more oriented toward private ownership and freedom. Now, unfortunately, about 15 years later, the Islamic forces came out of Arabia, and they conquered the Sasanian Empire. And they say that today this Mazdak group still lingers in Islamic culture, and it's sort of the main influence on the Shiites. But as far as Herod is concerned, and the Sanhedrin, first of all, they didn't convict Jesus. Jesus was convicted by the Romans. The Sanhedrin is a group of 71 rabbis who developed what we call rabbinic Judaism. I mean, they were both in Israel or Judea, and there was also a Sanhedrin in Babylon. And they wrote what we call the Talmud, which developed over a period of, I don't know, about 500 years. Do I think that's communist? No, not at all. I think that, if anything, the Talmud is simply a set of dialogues that are trying to get to the closest understanding of what God has in mind in the Torah, in the first five books of Moses. And it applies the principles of the Torah to everyday life. It's based on a very strong moral code that's given birth to Christianity and to the United States and to the Western civilization. So, no, I don't think they were communists at all. I think they were quite the opposite. Hello? All right, thanks for calling. Well, you're welcome to join me. This is great. Come on down. 855-915-9636. 855-915-9636. I don't think that I'm going too far out on a limb to say that I think there was more than a slight whiff of anti-Semitism in that caller. If you think otherwise, you're welcome to join me and challenge me on that. So getting back, the thing is that in the atmosphere of today, there is not the kind of open, free, you know, dialogue. Now you have people being reported to this agency, this bias control group. So you don't have the ability to speak too freely on topics. I feel that kind of pressure. I'm afraid to have guests here because I'm afraid that if they say something that's not politically correct, then that'll be the excuse that'll be used to take me off the air. So at least I feel that if I'm going to have to go off the air, it'll be because of myself. I'll take responsibility for it. I own every word that I say on this program. It's all streamed live. It's all podcasted, by the way, on my podcast. So every utterance that I make is a matter of public record, and I stand by it. I'm not saying I'm perfect. There are plenty of mistakes, and I may be quite wrong on issues, but I still stand by the basic spirit of what I'm trying to do here, which is to have a, I hope, an honest dialogue and to introduce some ideas and some concepts that might make people think and that may result in good, solid, honest discourse, which at least by definition is what a college is supposed to be all about. So, you know, that's my hope. I've noticed that there's a different atmosphere, frankly, because it's almost like I'm like Rumpelstiltskin in a way. I mean, it's like I was asleep for 20 years. I was here in 1998, 1997. I then left to do a lot of things. I ran for office. I ran a company that became a national business until it went under, frankly. I was on radio shows around. I did radio shows in stations around Greater Boston. I wrote almost 15 books. I'm finishing a book right now that I'm hoping is published in the fall, which deals with the history of American assassinations and assassination conspiracies. It's a fascinating piece of research for me. But I came back here in November of last year. So in a way, I have an opportunity to take a picture, in a way, of two contrasting times. And so the atmosphere back then, frankly, and I did meet more young people back then because there was just more activity in the station, was one of open, ribald, rigorous conversation and debate between people of various opinions. Certainly, I was the lone conservative, but nevertheless, there was an openness, there was a willingness to talk. Back then, I interviewed Noam Chomsky, I interviewed the late Howard Zinn, I interviewed Congressman Barney Frank, whom I eventually ran against in 2004. I interviewed lots of, Gloria Steinem, Sarah Gold. I mean, there was a whole long list of prominent liberal left thinkers that came on my program, both here and in my other programs. Now they don't come on anymore. You know, I mean, I've noticed in recent years that there's been a contracting, a kind of a looking within. They don't want to debate anymore because they don't think they can win the debate. But they don't come on anymore, very rarely, especially if they know who I am. And with internet being what it is, it's much easier to learn about someone. So they look me up and they say, aha, you know, so they don't come on. And there's a kind of a rudeness now, I mean, a sort of an ugliness, frankly, in that it's not even that they don't come on and send me a note saying, gee, Chuck, we really have to decline the offer. Thank you very much, but we're not interested. We don't agree with you. We can't make it, whatever. Now, it's like I don't even exist. They don't even respond. It's like I'm not in the room. That's become quite common. I'm not acknowledged. And by the way, it's not just liberals who are like that either. And that's interesting. I mean, maybe that's a kind of a polarization effect of our times. I don't know. I mean, I think that Barack Obama as president deserves a lot of the blame for the polarization in our society that we now have, because I think he used that as a dialectic to advance his power while he was president. And I think it was damaging and it's hurt this country. We're much more divided now because of that on false definitions like race and gender. I think that Trump has also inadvertently added to some of the problems, not so much by his policies, but because of his some rather strange and unpleasant quirks in his personality. And that's too bad. But I don't think he has a bigger agenda to do that. I think that's just a byproduct of his own I don't know, sloppiness or carelessness. But anyway, I notice now that there's the atmosphere back then, as I said, was more open, more relaxed, more confident. Now, young people don't talk to me anymore. And I don't think it's because I'm an old fart either. I think it has more to do with the fear that people know that I was reported to this agency because there was an article about it in the Tufts newspaper. And it was not a pretty article either. Not the kind of thing I'd want to show people. And they're fearful. I don't blame them. You know, I mean, you could end up getting written up to this Gestapo group. You could end up having your name dragged in the mud. You could end up seeing your name in an article in a magazine. You could have your parents contacted. You know, you have people who are students here whose parents are spending upwards of $60,000 a year. You know, do you want to jeopardize that? Do you want to jeopardize your future? Do you want to jeopardize your place? I mean, you could get kicked out of school. You know, so I'm not blaming them. I mean, there's actually a case. I mean, this is a case in point. Back on election eve on Wellesley College, which could have been any college. I'm not singling out Wellesley. I actually think Wellesley's a more conservative college than many of the others. But the problem is that there was a couple of guys who were celebrating the victory of Donald J. Trump. And they did it by driving through the campus in their little truck with, you know, Make America Great Again hats on and T-shirts. Well, they might have been waving an American flag. And they just drove around the campus. You know, they did, like, the campus has a road that basically connects. It's a beautiful place, but it connects all the parts of the campus. And that's all they did, right? Several hours later, someone on the campus made a phone call to either it was the campus police or it might have been, you know, maybe that college has an anti-bias Gestapo. I don't know. But they claimed that these people had done something that was indicated racial bias. It was a very vague charge. They had stopped in front of someone who happened to be African-American and they didn't look right or they didn't say something right or just their presence was fearful to them. And the result is that they ended up almost being kicked out of school. There was hearings. It was in the paper. It was, you know, it became a big story. I even think it went national. And these three guys who were students at Babson College, which is nearby, it's in Wellesley, they almost had their lives destroyed over this. The parents were brought in. The president of Babson had closed-door hearings where they weren't allowed to testify. I mean, it was just ugly. And, you know, what were they doing? They were celebrating the victory of their guy, Trump. You know, would people get in trouble for having celebrated Hillary's victory by riding around with a Hillary flag? I don't think so. You know, this is what people do in a free country. Donald Trump, by the way, was the Republican nominee. We're not talking about some fringe candidate here. You know, we're talking about somebody who, by the way, won the election. You know, and the fact that these guys had the audacity to celebrate this was seen as somehow offensive, or it was a trigger word, or it was like deeply troubling. I know that, you know, in Boston Public Schools, they actually sent out counselors to help young people get through this emotionally. I mean, for God's sakes, this is something to celebrate. The fact that every 4 years we have an election where there is a change in government. It's a nonviolent revolution every 4 years. What do they expect? You know, they're filled with such hatred and such viciousness and rage. You know, I mean, I've never seen anything like it. It is so vindictive. And you know something? It hasn't stopped. They're continuing with it. And I'll give you the example because I'm about to talk about an article I'm working on for Newsmax. It's not going to be published yet because I haven't done enough. I have to prove what I'm saying a little bit more, and I need to go deeper. But it's the general thesis is there. And that is this really nasty business around these horrifying protests in Charlottesville, Virginia, where on the one side you had, you know, Nazis and Ku Klux Klan and white supremacists, and then on the other side you had these communistic Antifa people. You know, basically it reminded me of what went on in Weimar Germany before Hitler, where you had Nazi and communist thugs battling it out on the streets, you know, and basically both sides helping the other side by raising their profile and getting more publicity and causing the government to take more extreme actions to try to suppress them until eventually, you know, one of those groups, the Nazis, came to power. I'm not saying it's that bad, but I'm pointing out that both sides are pretty ugly. But instead of, I mean, Donald Trump sent out a tweet condemning the hate and condemning the violence and condemning these groups. But because he didn't specifically say the Nazis, he said both sides. That was used by these propaganda agitators to claim that this means at last, aha, that Donald J. Trump has something against black men and women, which is a damn lie, and everyone knows it. But they've used it as a bludgeon, and of course, all these ridiculous, you know, weak-kneed Republicans who are controlling Congress right now suddenly are like falling in line with this. This is exactly, if there's anything that was achieved by the victory of Donald J. Trump in this election, and there are a lot of things that I could point to, but philosophically, culturally, it is that he stood up against this tyranny of political correctness. He said, no, I am not going to be called racist. I'm not going to be told I got something against black men and women because I don't goose step and zig heil to the left. He stood up to this. He called them out. He called the people who are doing this what they are: reprehensible, miserable human beings. And he resonated with people when he did it. And I point out to my listeners here, including especially my liberal listeners, that he did this for all of us because we don't want that kind of tyranny in this country. Well, it was that very tyranny, this mindset, that someone can be attacked and destroyed like this for saying, oh, you have something against black men and women, you know, with these flimsy, you know, pieces of evidence. Talk about lack of evidence. Because they didn't look the right way, they didn't say something at this minute versus that minute, they waited till 7 o'clock to do it instead of 6 o'clock, they didn't say it enough times, that they can be destroyed over this. This is something that all fair-minded people ought to reject. I mean, it's ridiculous. Everyone knows that Trump has nothing against black people. Come on. I mean, really. But anyway, the article that I'm writing here is taking a little bit of a look at the modern history of American Nazism. I haven't really looked too much at the Klan and the white supremacists, but I would probably put them in the same boat. And that is that they are essentially agents provocateurs, as they might say in French, or provocative agents, as they might say in English. Now, what do I mean by agents provocateurs? Well, I mean, this is it's an old left-wing and, frankly, world policy. It goes back. It's a classic tactic where you basically thread into your opposition members of your own party paid by you, set up by you, who then go ahead and do things internally to discredit you. So, you know, in other words, like if you were a communist group in the 1920s and 1930s who wanted to undermine the main opposition, what was the main opposition to communism back then? The church. So what do? You go in and you start churches with your own members, or you infiltrate churches. But in this case, I'm talking about starting them. And you pose as ultra-religious, win over followers, and then do things that hurt, embarrass, and discredit the church without anyone noticing. That's an agent provocateur. You know, you go into, you know, the opposition political party and you set up things. I mean, it's, you know, you're posing as something other than who you are to try to agitate and discredit and weaken the opposition. I mean, what I'm talking about here is a classic subject. It's well documented in history. In fact, this might be the topic of my next book, once I'm finished with the one I'm working on right now, which is American Assassinations. And my premise is that the American Nazis are at least headed by, if not made up of, agent provocateurs. These people are not real Nazis. I mean, they don't love Hitler. You know, they may be anti-Semites, but they're not, you know, they're not trying to create a national socialist state in the United States. I mean, at least not in the formal sense. I mean, if you want to take a look at the real national socialists, we could look at people on the left, but that's another subject. Let's save that one for another day. The point I'm making in my research, and again, my research right now is very incomplete, is that there are Nazi agent provocateurs in the American Nazi Party, and that this had a lot to do with the instigation at Charlottesville. So, let me just read a little bit here of my article as it stands now, and I'll comment as I go. There was something about the Nazis and the white supremacists at Charlottesville that was just a little too convenient. There was something about how the legacy media amplified the presence of these motley fringe groups, making them famous in advance, that was just a little too superstitious. The use of agent provocateurs or provocative agents is an age-old classic left-wing tactic. I present this thesis not as a conspiracy theory per se, but simply as an opinion as an observation of what appears to me to be obvious. As a Jew who had family members murdered in the Holocaust, and as the author of books on the Holocaust, including Was Hitler a Leftist?, I have dedicated many hours studying this topic. The late author and journalist Dr. Samuel L. Blumenfeld wrote an article that, in my opinion, documents how the American Nazi Party, established in 1960, was a communist front, and how its founder, George Lincoln Rockwell, was a communist agent provocateur. This becomes obvious to any casual observation of Nazi ideology. Rockwell, who was friendly with Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad of the Nation of Islam, a black supremacist group, was a lieutenant commander in the Navy who had attended Brown University and who ran a publication for the military. He was a slick and sophisticated operator who was a master at public relations. Where did he get the money to stage these slick rallies that, while sparsely attended, got a lion's share of media attention? All right, well, first of all, let me comment. The late Dr. Samuel Blumenfeld, who did hundreds of hours of radio with me and who actually started with me right here at this station, WMFO, back in 1990s, late 1990s, and who was a dear friend of mine and who passed away about 2 years ago and who I miss terribly, and who I just think about what he would say about things today. He was a brilliant man, author of a whole shelf of books, great researcher, developed really the father of homeschooling in many ways. He traveled around the world helping homeschool, wrote manuals for them. He wrote books on education, revealing the fraudulent, leftist agenda of education and how it's deliberately dumbing down students. Great man. Brilliant man. Well, he wrote an essay about this, a column about it, that was unpublished. It's still unpublished. I happen to have it. It's online. You can see it now. It's on the Camp Constitution website, where he goes over, point by point, the life and the career of John Lincoln Rockwell. Now, John Lincoln Rockwell, he started, George Lincoln Rockwell, excuse me, he established the American Communist Party, the American Nazi Party in 1960. Now, there had been no Nazi Party in America before that. There had been, whatever Nazi Party ever existed here was disbanded voluntarily at the time of Pearl Harbor in 1941, because, the same thing with the communists, frankly. They became pro-American. They put aside their radical, orientation because they wanted to side with the United States. I think that regardless of whether they were sincere about that, that's a very interesting question. But they did. Even the Communist Party back then disbanded. They didn't totally disband. They became like a Marxist reading group. Well, in the case of the Nazi Party, they did completely disband when we declared war on Nazi Germany. They didn't come back. The Communist Party did, but that's another story. The fact of the matter is that at the time that George Lincoln Rockwell set up this little tiny group of guys in his home in Arlington, Virginia in 1960, there was no Nazi Party. And the whole thing, and Sam goes into this point by point, it was very, very fishy. It was very phony. They would start strutting around with brown shirts and doing Zig Heils, and it was almost comical. And they would put on these ridiculous rallies where they would talk, which they called hate nannies. Now, this is like, who the heck calls something a hate nanny? Do you think the Nazis actually thought of themselves as haters? No, that's like, nobody thinks of themselves like that. It was like clownish. And they would go out and he would make these ridiculous statements. And if you see, you can see him on video, on YouTube. You can see that the man was not stupid. He was very sophisticated, very handsome, very suave. People said that as a person, he was very personable and likable. He was a successful businessman who had run an ad agency. He was run a magazine. He went to Brown University, as I said. He was honorably discharged from the military, had a military career as a pilot. He was married to a very prominent Icelandic family his wife's uncle had been the prime minister of Iceland. He was a well-to-do, well-bred, sort of a establishment, liberalish kind of a guy. And all of a sudden, he's there with this, coming out with these rallies on the mall in Washington and in Chicago, with these starchy suits, with these speeches and on these little set-up stages that looked like something that was a pop-up. And they would have, slick, literature and all this. And he actually started a record company where he was, trying to, write pop music. The whole thing, and it's too much to get into right now, but you could check out Sam's essay. He shows how they were really in line with the communist agenda. how his magazine would have been used by the communists to spy on American military installations around the world. It was a magazine that was for the military. How he even recounts this meeting he had with this communist guy who said, we're going to fund you from the Soviet Union. But he says, of course, he didn't do this. He doesn't name who the guy was. He doesn't name, you know, where the meeting took place. But he describes it in some detail. And if you read this article, you can see quite clearly that Sam was right. I mean, he really made the case that this was nothing more than a communistic thing. It was an attempt by the communists to set up this group in the United States as a way to do several things. I mean, they could agitate race conflict, which is always what the communists do, you know, to create the dialectic. It was around the 1960s that the communists switched from an emphasis to class conflict to race conflict, partially because of the work of Caribbean philosopher Frantz Fanon, who wrote a book called Wretched of the Earth. He said that the real dialectic moving forward in order to create a world communist movement is race, not class, not just financial. And so a guy like George Lincoln Rockwell, that is a way to fan race conflict. And he did have a lot of interactions, apparently, with the Nation of Islam under Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad, who were black nationalists. So you'd say that, or black supremacists, whereas what Rockwell posed as a white supremacist. And, you know, back then the media gave him a huge amount of attention. You know, they took this motley, it couldn't have been any more than a couple of dozen people. I mean, maybe at their height they might have had 100 people, maybe even 200. We're talking about something that they would stage these events, and the media would put it up the flagpole, writ large, look at this, and we would hear about how this is the conservatives secretly, you know, this is the front of what the conservatives really are. You know, this, we would have to hear these intellectual, you know, diatribes that would go on ad infinitum, insufferably, dissecting how the conservative milieu gave birth to this, and the conservative milieu did this and that. And we would hear all these smart aleck, you know, columnists and professors and newspapers and culture critics just ringing up Rockwell as this figure and holding him up. So, you know, they were playing up. Now, whether or not they were communists, I have no idea. Probably not. They were just liberals who have typical, you know, it's like they've got a little computer, you know, chip implanted in the back of their skulls. You know, they know what to do. You know, I had a communist uncle who once said to me, I asked him, what do you do? Do you follow the Kremlin? And he's like, no, we don't need to. We just know what to do. You know, they don't have to get orders from the Kremlin. They just react. I mean, it's sort of a political philosophy. They know how to, it's like a way of thinking. So they knew and they got the fact that George Lincoln Rockwell was somebody they needed to promote. And they needed to promote him large and make him into a bigger figure. You know, he was a nobody, a complete zero. They needed to ring him up. So you had, you know, liberal column, muttraking columnist Drew Pearson doing articles about George Lincoln Rockwell while he was still like, had three members in the bedroom of his house in Arlington. He would unfurl a Nazi swastika and put it out the window so that Drew Pearson would see it. And he happened to be a neighbor there. And he would put it in his columns. You know, that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about a phony front group, a turf group, probably, you know, completely financed at that time by the Soviet Union, according to Sam Blumenfeld's research. And they would go out and they would try to agitate riots and violence because it served the purpose of the left. Well, one of, by the way, George Lincoln Rockwell was assassinated in 1967. I get into this in my book. That's why I'm up on it. That's why I read Sam's article, by the way. And not to get into a topic, but it's a matter of public record. You can see this on YouTube. Rockwell himself addresses it. The fact is that his group was known to be pretty gay. And this is nothing against gay men, but there were a lot of gay people in his group. And his assassination might have had something to do with that. It might have been like a lover's thing. We don't know. But the point is that after he was assassinated, one of his proteges, this guy by the name of David Duke, would become the Grand Kleagle, I guess, of the Ku Klux Klan. He no longer is. But he looks to me to be similar to Rockwell. I'm not saying he's paid by the communists. I have no idea. But somebody's paying him. He's very slick. He's good looking. He's got a very nice blonde haircut. Wears very expensive suits. You know, he kind of, you know, oils his way around. And he is used by the media in the same way that Rockwell was used. They ring him up the flagpole and say, you see, this is the conservative movement. It's a way to discredit conservatism and to silence it and to mock it and to make it so that it's not taken seriously. So that every time now, whoever the politician is, anyone who doesn't genuflect to the left, they have to say, so, what do you think of David Duke? And of course, David Duke is happy, just like Rockwell was. Oh, he's more than happy to play along. He comes out, he endorses Donald Trump for president. So then Donald Trump could then be asked, so what do you think of David Duke's endorsement? And because he doesn't say it's bad quick enough, or he doesn't say it fast enough, or he doesn't say it with this word or that word, all of a sudden, aha, you see, he's in the Ku Klux Klan. All right. So it's the same principle that applies here. You know, he's there to cause trouble for conservatives. I mean, we could get into a talk about how the Klan is actually a Democratic Party organization that was set up after the Civil War and that was destroyed at the time by Republican President Ulysses S. Grant. And then it was revived by Democrat President Woodrow Wilson. We could talk about that. And we could talk about how Nazism is essentially a leftist idea. I wrote a whole book on that, as I mentioned. Was Hitler a leftist? We could talk about that, but that's too much to get into right now. We're reaching toward the end of the program. But suffice it to say that these groups and the way they're amplified are serving a purpose. Now, what was going on then in Charlottesville? You had the liberal media promoting this event and these groups. Oh, the white supremacists are coming. The white supremacists are coming. It was almost like Paul Revere riding in the countryside. The British are coming. And they put the spotlight on it. You had media coming in from all over the world to cover it. And then, of course, the communistic Antifa shows up. And it's almost like they're working together. You know, it's sort of like, as I said, it's like the Nazis and the communists in Weimar Germany. And the media's out there taking pictures. And some real nut job drives a car into a crowd and kills a girl, which I think that was overboard. I don't think anybody expected that. We don't know who he is, by the way, or what he was about. But putting that aside, this was used to grasp into these stereotypes of Republicans and conservatives, and particularly of President Trump, by then criticizing anything he might have said. It wouldn't have mattered what he said. It wouldn't have mattered what he tweeted. The script had already been written. Donald Trump is on the Nazis' side. That's, you know, he likes Nazism. Yes, of course. He doesn't like black people. That was already written in the newsrooms of places like CNN and MSNBC. where they are at war with Trump. They just despise Trump. And by the way, I understand why they do. Trump is a revolutionary figure who could very potentially tear down this entire rotten edifice that they have built over this past century that has deprived us of our freedom and of our prosperity. Trump does threaten that in a real way. Now, whether or not he fulfills it, I'm starting to have my doubts, frankly, now that he's gotten rid of Steve Bannon, who I view as a hero, and Sebastian Gorka and others. Yeah, it worries me. I'm not sure that Donald is going to do and be what he said he was going to be. I question that. But whether or not, it's almost not all, it's not, it would be great if he was, but the relevant point is not Donald Trump as a man. The point is why he was elected. He was elected because he stood for certain principles that resonate with Americans. Principles because they're good and natural. That's what we need to stay focused on. Trump could be his own worst enemy at times. But the fact is that he fell into the trap of this staged event. All right, let me continue with my article here. And again, my research is still in its early stages, and I don't think Newsmax is going to publish it until I come up with some more meat on the bone, and I'm working on it. The liberal media was more than anxious to oblige his small band of misfits, and that being the Rockwell Group, by launching them into the national spotlight where they were hoisted up like a specimen representing the conservative movement that was emerging at the time. Even if Rockwell was not an agent provocateur, he and the communists found a common enemy in the conservative movement that they both sought to subvert and undermine. David Duke was a protege of George Lincoln Rockwell, and he spouts the same racist, anti-Christian, anti-capitalist propaganda. His ideas, and those of his ilk, strangely resonate with the left-wing radical identity movement that is becoming so prevalent on American college campuses today. Now, ain't that the truth? Oh, I've just had a little problem with my computer. I don't know if somebody's sending a message or something, but it looks like they just it just was dumped or something. Anyways, I don't need it right now. I can continue on here. That is a shot at the political correctness movement on campus. It seems to me to be a race identity movement, very similar to, frankly, Nazi socialism, white supremacy. It's not in the formal sense in that they're saying that one race is better than the others, which is what either white or black supremacy is about. But in a mild sense, and again, I do say mild, it is hyper-conscious of things like race and ethnic background and sex and sexuality. These things they loom extremely large in the identity of a person. A person is expected to very publicly identify themselves in any one of these categories. To do so is seen as a great virtue. To not do so is seen as a deficiency, as a form of cowardice. And this kind of polarization, this kind of collectivism, it's first of all, it's classic leftism because it's putting, you're sublimating and ultimately sacrificing your own individual identity to some sort of an external thing, some external idea. But it also, you know, serves the old communist dialectic of conflict. Now, I'm not saying, therefore, that there's someone sitting out there in the Kremlin making this happen. I don't think that at this point. I think it's now more of a kind of an internalized idea that emanates from an establishment. But either way, it's it does create. There are similarities that we could point to. I could point to between the political correctness movement that has come to dominate college campuses and the sort of the radical white supremacist Antifa movements, which are highly involved in categorical identification, that you are identified by and therefore defined by things like your race, your ethnic background, your sexual orientation, your gender. And, to my way of thinking, that is antithetical to an American approach, which is that we are defined by who we are as individuals, not by the color of our skin, but by the content of our character. That was Martin Luther King's dream. That was an American dream. That's why he's as great a figure as he is, because he rejected race categorization as a primary identifier of who you are. George Washington talked about this in his farewell address, which was partially written by Alexander Hamilton. I don't have it in front of me, so I'm going to paraphrase. He said that while he respects the fact that Americans at that time, even back then, were diverse in culture, religion, what he called manners, there were local understandings, that he hoped, and that his fervent prayer and his hope in his farewell address was that Americans would identify as Americans first, that we would identify them ourselves and our cultures as America. And then secondly, by whatever religious, cultural, racial, sexual identification we've embraced, and to the degree we've embraced any. That's personal. There's nothing wrong with identifying those things. I think it's quite good, actually. Look, I identify very openly as a Jew. I don't have a problem with that. I'm proud to. It's what I am. It's who I, but the point is that I understand from Washington's standpoint that I'm an American first, and I hope that people understand that. That's what this whole political correctness movement is getting away from. Suddenly, first you're black, or you're gay, or you're Hispanic, or you're Asian, or you're, a woman, or you're transgender, or whatever it is. That becomes the looming important feature and even virtue in your life. It's who you are, as opposed to that those things, while important, ultimately are private. That's your business. That's you're free to be that, but it's something that's a personal choice. And how you relate to those things is personal. Do you want to have someone else outside you defining how you should relate to those things? I don't think that's the way to go. Anyway, I see we've reached the end of the program. I shall return, God willing, next Thursday at 10 a.m. You're welcome to listen to the rerun of this program on my podcast apparatuses. You can just look it up by putting my name in the server, Chuck Morse Speaks. That's Chuck Morse, Morse like Morse code. MORSE, and you will see the podcast come up on iTunes, Podomatic, Stitcher, YouTube. What is it? There's a bunch of channels that it comes up. Google Play. I'm on a lot of them, and the podcast is doing very well, by the way. So I want to thank you all for that. And my column is up on Newsmax every week. My books are available at Amazon. I'll just put my name in the server, Chuck Morse, M-O-R-S-E, like Morse code, and you shall see a whole group of books come up that are by me. It's about 15 books at this point. Anyway, so I want to thank you all for listening today. Let me just try to call up the operation here. We need to get to the Rivendell. There it is. Let me just see here. Rivendell automation. There we go. Go continuous. Is that